c'est Lorraine. Vous faites partie des fidèles de La Poudre. Vous venez tout juste de découvrir ce podcast. Dans les deux cas, j'ai un message important pour vous. À partir du 20 octobre prochain, La Poudre s'écoutera en exclusivité sur Spotify. Oui, oui, vous avez bien entendu. Bientôt, La Poudre, ça sera sur Spotify et pas ailleurs. Donc, si vous ne voulez pas louper la saison 6, je vous recommande très fort de vous abonner au flux de La Poudre sur l'application Spotify dans la rubrique Podcast. Ça reste gratuit, évidemment, il suffit de se créer un compte. Je compte sur vous pour me suivre chez Spotify, votre soutien est très important. Allez, on se retrouve le 20 octobre, je vous réserve des épisodes plus explosifs que jamais. Allez, en place. C'est La Poudre.
Tiens, on a découpé une femme en morceaux rue de la bienséance à deux pas du chat.
Tiens, on a découpé une femme.
I am a feminist.
Je vous obsède avec une constance.
Je ne suis pas conduite.
Qui appelle quand même l'admiration.
Je suis conduite d'une façon conforme à ce qu'on attend d'une jeune fille d'abord et d'une femme ensuite.
I'm sorry that I didn't become the world's first black classic pianist.
Des femmes artistes, activistes, inspirantes, politiques. Puissant.
Je crois qu'une femme qui existe dans son temps, à l'intérieur de son temps,
n'a pas d'époque, elle marque son époque.
Dans la
boum
poudre. I am Lauren Bastide, and today my guest is Margaret Atwood.
If we all turned off the oil tomorrow, we would have the most amazing societal breakdown, civil war, starvation, and catastrophe, because we're too addicted to it right now. We need to transition.
Before jumping into the fifth season of La Poudre, like each fall, I have three episodes in English in store, because look at me going international. The first one that you're about to listen to is an interview I recorded last winter with the great Canadian writer Margaret Atwood. With COVID-19, we hadn't had the chance to publish it yet, so here it is, French and new, just for you. What an honor it was to have been able to talk at length with this incredible author, queen of dystopia, whose genius mind gave birth to The Handmaid's Tale in 1985, and who published its sequel last year, The Captivating and Chilling Testaments. I hope you'll enjoy it. With Margaret Atwood, we talked about forests, science, and religion. Margaret Atwood, it's a big honor to interview you today. Thank you so much for being here.
You're so welcome.
So you've written dozens of amazing novels and poetry books. You've received many, many awards. And you just published the sequel, The Testaments, the sequel of La Servante Écarlate. I'm going to say it in French because it's the way everybody knows it here. Why did you feel like writing the sequel after 35 years?
Because after a number of years, when we thought history was moving away from this totalitarian theocracy of Gilead, it turned around and started moving back towards it, most notably in the United States. So in other parts of the world, we seem to have been moving away from it, such as in Ireland. But there, in the middle of Trump land, we are moving increasingly towards it. So it seemed to be a very good time to revisit Gilead and explore possibly how it fell apart.
It's interesting you talk about this going backwards, because I think when you published the book in 1985, it was a very different mood, and some left-wing people didn't agree with you that things could go backwards.
I know.
It's incredible how, like, it seemed so obvious to people in the 80s we were only going to progress towards more human rights, and you were, like, kind of warning them.
Watch
like,
it.
Be careful.
Yes, because I've never believed it can't happen here, and I've never believed in the inevitable yellow brick road to the city of Oz. There is no inevitable direction, and things frequently go backwards. As you can see by looking over the last 4,000 years of human history.
Mm-hmm. When you wrote this book, you were in Berlin?
I started in West Berlin, circled by the famous Berlin Wall, And at that time, I visited East Germany and Czechoslovakia and Poland as well. And each one of those countries was still behind the Iron Curtain, but each one was quite different. And the most closed was East Germany. Somewhat more open was Czechoslovakia, but you had to be very careful where you talked to people because they all felt that they were being watched all the time. And in Poland, it was much more open because there was a big opposition, and that was the Catholic Church. Not noteworthily democratic in and of itself, but in opposition to the communists of Poland, and quite large, so they couldn't kill them all.
Hmm. Do you remember what was your state of mind while you were writing this book?
When I was writing this book, I had started thinking about it in 1981, because we had seen at the end of the 60s the making public of the second wave women's movement that had been simmering along throughout some of the 60s, and then it became visible at the end of the 60s and was very active in the 70s and got a number of different laws changed. It did not succeed in changing the putting through the Equal Rights Amendment because there was a very strong opposition headed by a woman, namely Phyllis Schlafly, and so that amendment did not pass at that time, but other laws did, so people obtained the right to control their reproductive lives. They obtained the right to control their financial lives. They could have bank accounts of their own if they were married. They could have mortgages. All of those things were changed in that decade. In the 80s, there began a pushback. We saw the election of Ronald Reagan. So I started thinking about it in 1981 and collecting newspaper and magazine clippings because people were saying then, in the 80s, what they would later come to enact once they got the power. So you could already see it moving, but because I had studied 17th century Puritan civilization of New England, I knew that the foundation of the United States in that part of the world was a theocracy. It didn't begin as a democracy. And even when the 18th century Enlightenment arrived and we had the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, etc., underneath that was still this Puritan theocratic ideas, and also slavery was still a going concern. And slavery at that time was quite supported by biblical quotations. People used the Bible in that way while forbidding actual slaves to read it so they wouldn't find out what was really in it. So it is in...
So many inspirations for the
book. So it is, yes. And there's other examples, of course, from the United States themselves, namely the Mormons, who at the beginning were polygamous, quite thoroughly. So, and they got that idea from the Bible as well. They justified it from the Bible. So, the Bible is a book or a collection of books, in which you can find some passage or other that will justify almost anything. Mm-hmm. So the Bible that you have is the Bible you choose.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the point of view you have on religion, and I really want us to have a minute to talk about it later. But it's incredible because actually you were already pre-sensing what Susan Faludi would later call the backlash. It was already like an intuition.
It was already there.
It was there.
Yeah.
It was happening.
It was already happening, but you had to look in the back pages and less prominent parts of publications to find it, but it was there.
And connect the dots together.
Connect the dots. And one thing they did in the red states was to seize control of education as quickly as they could. Mm. So they had a plan, and they have carried it out to considerable effect.
Yeah.
So in the sequel, we find one of the very important character of the first book, Aunt Lydia. But this time she's talking on the first person, and we find out that she's a whistleblower, which is a very, very intriguing plot twist, because she was a monster in the first book. And it kind of reminded me of Hannah Arendt and this idea that even a monster is a human, and that it's very difficult to divide humans between good and evil.
Well, you can say that their actions have been evil. It's what is difficult to say is to say that they're not human. So they are an extreme of what it is to be human. But let us not let ourselves off the hook that way by saying they are outside our own category and that they're not human. So I don't believe in monsters in that way. I believe in people who go to extremes in their behavior. But that is within the parentheses that we call human. It's human beings doing it. It's not squirrels or, you know, alligators.
It's also the idea that when you start to get her point of view, you understand what she's gone through, and maybe you understand better her violence and the actions.
The choices that she made.
Yes.
Kill or be killed.
Yes.
Well, a lot of people justify their actions in that way, and those have in fact been their choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's testimony, for instance, from people who took part in mass killings in Ecuador. And it was essentially, do what we tell you or we're going to shoot you. Mm. And so it is with the child soldiers in Rwanda and other places that are conscripted into these bands of armed people and told, you have to kill.
Mm. So I'm going to make a spoiler alert for the people who haven't read the book yet. Please skip a few minutes. But at the end of the book, Gilead finally is destroyed.
At the very end of the book, there's something we already knew from The Handmaid's Tale, which is that in 200 plus years, it doesn't exist anymore.
But we understand how it fell apart.
How it began to fall apart.
From the inside.
Yes.
Did you want to give your readers some hope that, okay, history and human rights can go backwards, but we can also like make it go clockwise again.
Nothing is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no one history. There is no one the future. And what kind of future we're going to get will depend a lot on the choices that we make now. So there isn't a single predetermined story.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when people say you're on the wrong side of history. I always think, which history?
Yes.
Which history are you on the wrong side of? Because it could turn the other way, in which case you would then be on the right side of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always difficult to run your life according to some predetermined notion of history. Instead, you should probably run it according to what you think is right now.
Mm. What you're saying reminds me also of this speech we hear about global warming and nature. Like we have this sense, this feeling of inevitability that we are going towards catastrophe. Are you trying to say that we could still?
Yes, people could still reverse it. And if you want to know how, you can go to a website called Project Drawdown, which has all of the techniques and practices, including the education of girls and women, that would lead to a drawdown of carbon out of the atmosphere rather than the emitting of carbon into the atmosphere. So a lot is already known about how we could do this. It's a question of collective and political will to make it happen.
Hmm. You've been aware of these questions very much before the society really become worried with this. Is it because you grew up in among nature?
I grew up with the biologists. I think you can grow up in nature without being that aware because things seemed more or less the same for a while.
Yeah, both your parents were scientists, right?
My dad was an entomologist. He worked with forest insects. My mom was a dietitian. So she's interested in food and nutrition. So lucky me, I had fresh vegetables because they made a garden and caught a lot of fish. So that was in the woods. Not so easy to make a garden there. You had to really work at it. Yeah. That was dinner table conversation in the 50s amongst the biologists.
And you mean your parents were already aware that the way society was building was going to destroy nature?
It was the age of Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. So that was one warning about one chemical that was destroying birds. But when you think of all of the other chemicals that we're putting into the biosphere now, and when you look at the very rapid decline, even of common species of birds, ones that we thought were abundant, it's no longer a question of rare species. And when you also look at the amount of fish there are now compared to the amount that there were 50 years ago, it's a slippery slope, and it's quite a steep slope. So you can't keep taking without putting back. Mm-hmm. It's a finite biosphere. You also cannot kill the oceans without choking to death, because it is the oceans that make 60 to 80% of the oxygen that we breathe. So those are the things that we have to really concentrate on. The carbon, the oceans, and the chemicals.
Mm-hmm. And also there is, even in this Scarlet Servant already, this idea that the future of nature and the future of women are very closely linked. It's already like a type of ecofeminism you're imagining.
They are pretty closely linked. Anything that affects cancer rates, fertility rates, mm-hmm. child cancer rates, all of these things is going to be pretty close to women. But also, when you have famines, tornadoes, heat waves, all of those things, when the food supply shrinks, mm-hmm. you're going to have not only starving people, you're going to have social unrest, you're going to have wars. And wars have never been a tippity-top good thing for women or children.
Yes.
They're not a good thing for anybody, but particularly that sector of the population.
Mm.
So most refugees, as you know, are predominantly women and children, and they're very vulnerable in that refugee state.
Yes. We are going through a third, someone say fourth wave of feminism, and that the scarlet robe of your servants have become a really strong symbol. We can see many of them in the protests against Donald Trump in the U.S., for example, or as a protection for abortion. Are you proud of this?
Well, I didn't do it, so I didn't do it myself. The readers and people putting on the outfit are the ones doing it, and it started, believe it or not, in Texas.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was a group of women in Texas who thought they would put these things on and go and sit in the Texas legislature where they were making restrictive laws about
women. It's not that surprising
women.
When you think about
it. Yes. Well, but Texas is now considered a purple state. It has a lot of people who are not these kinds of red state Republicans anymore. So in Texas, they thought at first they would order these outfits over the internet, which they did. But when they arrived, they were pink. So they said, this isn't what we've had in mind. So they very quickly sewed themselves some red ones and put the patterns up on the internet.
Wow.
So they made it to the legislature on time in red because they had done this sewing project themselves. So I'm pretty proud of them.
Mm.
It is a perfect symbol because you're sitting there, you're not saying anything. Nobody can kick you out for making a disturbance, and you're very modestly dressed. But everyone looking at you knows what you mean.
Wow.
So that is why it has spread hither and thither in the world, thanks also to the television show.
There also has been an incredible synchronization of watches, because the series adapted from your book came out at the very moment, more or less, that the Me Too movement was created.
Were not you? Quite. It came out in spring 17. The Me Too movement arrived in October 17, yeah. So about 6 months later.
A couple months, yeah, a few months.
But the reporters working on the Harvey Weinstein case were already hard at work by that time, and there's now two books out about it. One of them is called She Said, by the two woman reporters working on it, and the other one is called Catch and Kill, which is by Ronan Farrow, about the attempts made to suppress the reporting that he was doing on it, to suppress it at NBC, because he felt that they were covering up for somebody of their own. So the books are now out, and there's another one in Canada called Had It Coming by Robin Doolittle. So that is that's a trio of books about what happened during this period of time.
Alrighty. How does it feel to see characters and stories and sets that were only in your brain until now suddenly, like, real, not real, but like images, become images on television?
Well, I think they've done a very good job. And the reason that they did a very good job is that everybody involved in the series is dedicated to it. It's not just another show for them. So they threw themselves into it, to the extent even that the actresses doing it did it without makeup. Can you think of a
no makeup
bigger
at all.
Sacrifice?
Wow,
well,
yeah.
Of course, handmaids aren't allowed to wear makeup. So they had to do it without makeup.
They could have done a no-makeup makeup.
They didn't do that. They did absolutely bare-naked face acting.
That's impressive.
And the designer, who's called Anne Crabtree, who's now, you know, her costumes are in the Smithsonian, she considered 50 shades of red before choosing the right one.
Wow.
And similarly, she put similar attention into the other colors that she chose. So everyone really immersed themselves in the show. The showrunner himself, called Bruce Miller, had read the book as an adolescent and decided at the age of 19 that he was going to do it when he grew up. And he waited and waited and waited for it to become available. And when it did, he pitched himself, and he knew so much about it that they hired him. So he then hired a lot of women to work on it. He hired a writing room that's predominantly female. He hired a first director who had never directed drama before. She had directed music videos, which is one of the reasons it looks so good. and he made very judicious choices of who he hired. Mm-hmm. So it's been very interesting.
It's a good ally, this man. you wrote an article called Am I a Bad Feminist?
I know. That was at the height of this movement, when people were saying something that wasn't true.
Yeah, but I think it was really badly understood, this article. I think it was people probably misread it.
Because, I think they misread it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you say something that is, I think, the truest and most feminist thing you can say. You say Me Too is a symptom of a broken system.
That's true.
Could you develop this idea for me?
Yeah, well, if there are mechanisms in place to handle assault charges, you wouldn't have to go on social media like that, because you would have other means of dealing with it that would be more dependable mm-hmm. for you and for everybody concerned. But people were also saying at the height of the movement that you had to believe everything every woman said. We know from being women that that's not based on truth. And we know from everything that we see around us in history that once a thing becomes valuable, somebody will try to counterfeit it. And since that time, we have seen several examples of pretty high-profile false accusations. And those are about the worst thing you can do.
Of course.
To real women with real grievances,
victims.
Real cases. So it was probably a little premature to say that, since everybody then, some people yelled at me for saying it, but it happens to have been true.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing now is people now saying exactly the same thing. And I back an organization called After Me Too, which is going to make a website giving you all the information that you need to make an effective reporting, an effective and safe reporting, get immediate counseling, and lead to third-party professional investigations.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need that. You can't...
A tweet isn't enough to have a rapist come
down. It's not enough. It might work for a high-profile individual person, but when you read She Said, and when you read Catch and Kill, you will see the detailed, exhaustive investigation that went into these things. So cross-checking, fact-checking, interviews, obtaining documents, open and shut, ironclad, this is real.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what mainstream news organizations can do because they have the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be more than finger pointing.
Yes.
It has to be more. And I think now people will be more careful because we saw what happened with the University of Virginia case that happened not to be true. It cost the Rolling Stone $4.5 million and was really bad for the career of the reporter, who was a reputable, experienced reporter who published a story without fact-checking.
Yeah, we've had similar cases in France.
And you
it's
have?
It's really not helping women.
It doesn't help them at all. It casts doubt on the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about real ones is that high-profile cases are one thing, but there's a great deal of run-of-the-mill, people without visibly glamorous jobs.
Yes.
You know, people are just, working in a factory or something. You have to put up with the same kind of thing. So After Me Too will provide a vehicle for people like that to go see what are their choices. What are the avenues to pursue? A lot of people just don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm backing that.
Knowledge is key to be able to.
Yeah, exactly. What can I do? What is available to me? Where can I get help? What is going to result in a good outcome for me? And what, on the other hand, is just going to ruin my life?
Mm-hmm. I think that this article you wrote and also the reaction that happened after our cas d'école. I think it really shows, first of all, how much feminists can divide themselves and spend a lot of time fighting each other instead of fighting patriarchy. But it also shows that feminism deserves nuance. I don't know how it's...
Yes, nuance.
Nuance.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if literature and fiction wasn't, at the end of the day, the best way to bring feminism and women in general, the nuance it deserves.
Well, literature presents people as three-dimensional, four-dimensional, and five-dimensional entities, not just as cardboard cutouts of somebody's ideology. So it allows us to experience the life of another person in its wholeness, as it were, and it is the closest thing you can get to being another person.
Mm-hmm.
To seeing what it is like to actually be that person.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're right, but of course people who are interested only in ideological interpretations will then take the three-dimensional, four-dimensional, and five-dimensional people and criticize them for having nuance.
Yes, of course.
So then that is, of course, a totalitarian way of thinking,
mm-hmm.
either of the left or of the right.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this has been particularly helped by certain kinds of social media that don't allow for nuanced conversations.
I agree with you so,
so
much.
So it's just people hurling slogans at each other. But even if you go back to second wave feminism of the 70s, you will see that people had disagreements then too. They had disagreements. They fought. That happens. But it doesn't cause you to lose sight of the overarching goal, which is an improvement in equality for women, which is why the other organization that I support is called Equality Now. And it operates in, it's an international organization that works on improving laws that have to do with girls and women. So improving the law doesn't necessarily change everything all at once, but it makes things more possible. So if there's a law that says you can have your own bank account and you can have your own mortgage, that makes it possible for you to lead an independent financial life.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a law that says you can drive a car, it makes it possible for you to go places that otherwise you wouldn't go. So it gives you more autonomy. We must remember that there was a huge pushback against bicycles when they first came into view, because it was said that bicycles would make women immoral.
Mm-hmm. And make them lose their virginity almost, right?
Or do other immoral things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And to frighten them, they were told that they would get bicycle face if they rode bicycles. Bicycle face was that you would go so fast on the bicycle that your face would all get pushed back like that to instant facelift and lead me to it. So all of these things, the zipper was preached against when it first arrived, because zippers would make people immoral because it was easier and faster to get your clothes off.
Makes sense.
Yeah, all of these things, brassieres, same thing. Yes, all of this immoral clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be pushes and there will be pushbacks. What is best for women is a fairly stable society, which isn't so toxic chemically and so overheated and climate emergency'd that we're all going to die. You know, that would be my preference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mine too. And we were talking about how literature enables you to bring nuance to the feminism, the feminist thought, and you don't practice any kind of literature. You write anticipation, or you write, some people would call it dystopia, but I know you're not really comfortable with this.
I'm fine with dystopia.
Dystopia
is just a picture of a society that we think we wouldn't like to live in.
A dark future, yeah. There is another feminist author I've always loved. It's Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I think her Land is one of the most beautiful feminist books.
Way back then.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
And I was wondering why dystopia was such a powerful feminist tool.
Yeah, her Land is a utopia.
Yes.
Yeah, so she's showing a positive society run by women.
Yes.
So after the First World War, and particularly after the advent of the USSR and after the advent of Hitler's Germany, both of which came in as utopian propositions, after those things, and after the Second World War, it became harder for us to believe in utopias. So the dystopia was the form of the 20th century.
Yes.
I have seen a few utopias appearing again. So maybe we're gathering up the strength of will to try to believe in an improved form of society. They're usually green utopias. So we have climate fiction on the one hand, which shows climate catastrophes and all of their effects. But on the other hand, we see these green utopias beginning to appear.
Yes, it's a good thing to keep hope. But I was wondering if it was maybe helpful for women to be able to give a sensitive vision of what could the word be, because it's so hard to be listened in the present. I was wondering if writing the future was necessary for women to be heard?
I think if they do it well.
Yes,
so,
of course.
Yeah, if they do it well. And if it's powerful enough, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be two plans, the society that you don't want to be in, that's what I've been doing, and the other society that you do want to be in.
I wanted to ask you, please, to give a lesson of nuance about religion to French people. As you may know, French people, French democracy seems to be a bit allergic to anything that looks like religion, especially if it's Muslim. Right now, you probably heard about the debate that's going around the veil. Mm. And I think what's very powerful about your work is that you don't say that religion is evil. It's much more complicated than that. And I heard you say in an interview, religion can be a positive faith that helps and encourage people and comforts them in times of trouble.
That's true.
Or it could be a hammer that hit people over the head with.
And that those are both true. So
those are both true.
Yes, of course.
But I mean, it's incredible how in France, like, the government seem to be like wanting to like take religion away from people, and it's really revolting me. So
I don't see how they can take it away from people at an individual level. What they may be saying is, if you work in the government, you can't wear visible symbols of the religion.
Unfortunately, now they're talking about like the public space in general. Like
really?
The Minister of Education this morning said the public space is supposed to be a neutral place where you only speak rationally.
That's not true.
What are you talking about? We cannot dream anymore?
That's not true.
What's going on?
Yeah, so what about manifestation? Those are not usually rational.
No.
What about aubericade? Those usually take place in public spaces. They're not very rational. So what else does he want to ban if he bans people dressing the way they wish? Mm-hmm. So are we going to go back to measuring women's hemlines, or just exactly what does he have in mind?
No, but I really think there is a very big misunderstanding about like what religion and democracy don't have to be opposed, and I really think you're a very good converter of this idea that it's not that easy. And
it's not that easy, and there are two organizations that I support because they are green religious organizations, and the religions, if they put their minds to it, can have a lot of power. They could help save the planet if they got it into their heads that is something that they should be doing. And one of them is called Arosha, A-R-O-C-H-A, was started by an English bird watcher who was also a clergyman, an English clergyman bird watcher. How English.
Yes.
And the other one is called Sojourners, S-O-J-O-U-R-N-E-R-S. And they operate out of Washington, and they are inclusive, multiracial, and ecologically active Christian organization. And I have been at an event at which there were ecological Muslims, ecological Jews, and ecological Christians all appearing on the same platform. So these people could have a lot of influence for the good, if they really turned their minds to it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have some religious people who say, well, it's going to be the end of the world soon. I will be raptured up because I'm virtuous, and I will take great pleasure in watching the earth fry with everybody else on it. That, to me, is not love your neighbor.
No, definitely not.
I think it misses the point.
Mm-hmm.
So there always will be people who will try to use religion as a way of gaining power over others. So that we've seen that throughout the centuries a lot. And there always will be people who will take the core message of a religion and twist it into something quite different from what it was intended to be.
I was wondering what was the worst enemy. Yesterday, sorry if I seem to be bragging, but I was talking with Vandana Shiva, and she said that maybe it's even harder to fight Emmanuel Macron or Justin Trudeau. We're gonna have like apparently very green speeches, saying make our planet great again and Greta Thunberg is great, but on the other side won't apply it in law, or having an enemy as Donald Trump who says global warming doesn't exist and you can actually fight him because you disagree with him. What is your point of view on this?
My point of view is this. If we all turned off the oil tomorrow, we would have the most amazing societal breakdown, civil war, starvation and catastrophe, because we're too addicted to it right now. We need to transition, and there are a number of places that are doing that right now. For instance, the Orkney Islands, the Orkney, which is composed of a lot of islands, have a lot of wind power. They're using that wind power to make hydrogen, and they intend to convert their whole energy economy to hydrogen. They're doing, they're splitting H2O into H and O, which is what plant life in the oceans does. So they're using their surplus electricity to do that, and they intend to run even their ferry boats on that by, I think, 2022. So there are these examples of people who are already doing such things. And if you go onto the Project Drawdown website, you will find a number of them.
But so you see it's the individual initiative? We don't have to rely on the government anymore?
No, no. You say to the government, okay, here's what you said. Here's your here's what's coming out of your mouth. And here are the means by which you can accomplish that. By the way, so let's start. There are, in fact, in Canada now more green jobs than there are jobs in oil. So how you deal with the oil lobby is say, you know, you do what you want and you're going to kill a lot of jobs. So you show where the jobs actually are. You show where the savings actually are. It's happening at the level of cities right now. Our former mayor, David Miller, is part of this group of city mayors who are greening their cities now. So you take those tendencies that are already with us and push them out. Hmm. Bristol is a very green city right now. So how do we get off the grid? How do we wean ourselves from carbon-based energy sources?
You're actually quite optimistic, right?
Well, yeah, because I look at it. There's something in Canada called the Eco-Fiscal Commission, and it's made of what you might think of as right-wing businessmen. And they're saying, here's the financials on this, mm-hmm. and here's what you do, and here's why carbon taxes work, etc. If you want to go to another site called Permian Global, they're regenerating degraded tropical rainforests, which happens to be the cheapest, fastest way of drawing carbon down out of the atmosphere. One reason you should buy organic is that organic soils are carbon sinks, whereas if you kill organic soils, you release all of that carbon into the atmosphere. So it's not that non-organic foods will kill you. It's that if you have organic soils, they're keeping carbon out of the atmosphere. Mm. And right now I'm investigating preferable ways of disposing of your corpse.
Wow.
Whoa.
That's interesting.
That's extreme. Yes. There's an outfit called Recompose, a woman-run business on the west coast of the United States. And with Recompose, in order to save on urban space, so you could have a green burial if you've got lots of land, but if you don't have lots of land, you can do Recompose, in which you put your body into a pod, and quite quickly it turns into compost. Put it on the roses.
I really love the way you're actually a geek. You're such a geek.
It's true.
Can I have 5 more minutes? Thank you so much. It's okay with you, Margaret, sure. Just to finish the interview. There is I think I found out something about you that we share is the taste for archives. I really love the way, yeah, I can tell. Like, because actually the Testaments is like archives that are found like 200 years later and that are read by the future. Mm-hmm. And you also participated in this project that I think is really beautiful, Library of the Future, by this Danish artist called Katie Petersen.
And she's Scottish. So you can find it on the web, futurelibrary.no. Yes, futurelibrary.no.
And so you wrote a book that is not going to be read before 100 years.
That's right. I wrote a text that won't be read. It has to be made of words, whatever it is. But apart from that, there's no limit. So the rules are only 2 copies in the Future Library of Norway. Has to be made of words, no pictures. And you can't tell anybody what it is.
Only the title.
Only the title, which is Scribbler Moon.
What is it about?
Well, I can't tell you. I can't tell you that. So Katie is interested in words and time. So she wants texts that have words and time in them. So I put Scribbler for the words and Moon for the time.
Why are archives so important to you?
I think they're a little like Sleeping Beauty in that things go away and are forgotten. But if they're preserved somewhere, somebody then comes along and finds them. So we now have the Epic of Gilgamesh because somebody found these cuneiform tablets from thousands of years ago and was able to translate them. That only happened in the 19th century. It's not like the Iliad that was continuously known. It was rediscovered after being asleep for thousands of years. So I just think of them as sleeping things that are then awoken. They're awoken and they tell us things. Mm-hmm. And I find that fascinating.
And also there is this idea that you hope in the testaments, like women are not allowed to read and there is no longer any words in the public space because reading is dangerous.
Yes.
And by doing this is like the bet that people in 100 years were still...
It's a bet.
No,
it's a bet in the testaments. Aunt Lydia bets that somebody may find her text that she's hiding. And we're still discovering texts that were hidden during the Second World War. So she bets that somebody will find her text. And with the Future Library of Norway, we're making a lot of bets. We bet there will be people. We bet there will be a Norway. We bet that the forest that's growing to make the paper will actually grow. We bet that people will still be able to read. And we bet that people will still be interested in reading. So that's a lot of optimism just in one project.
Margaret Atwood, do you have access to your room of your own?
Do I have access to a room of my own?
Yes.
Absolutely. It does have a sign on the door saying keep out that everyone ignores.
Where is this room?
Where is my room? It's in my house. Yeah, my house is in Toronto. Toronto's in Canada.
Thanks. You've been touring for like almost 2 months now for the promotion of your book. Do you have like time to get withdraw a little bit from this?
I will have time shortly, but not for a couple of weeks.
When I tell you La Poudre, what do you think of?
La Poudre interested me immediately as a name because it means, first of all, the thing that you powder your face with to appear more angelic. We all do that. And secondly, of course, it's explosive powder that you use to blow things up with. So 2 meanings.
Thank you so much, Margaret Atwood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Margaret Atwood for speaking up in La Poudre. Nouvelles Écoutes is the executive producer of La Poudre, a podcast produced by Aurore Meyer-Maillet, prepared and recorded by Gaia Marty, and mixed by Marion Emery.